There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Where to Go. I'm James Atkinson, Senior Brand Manager at DK Eyewitness.
And I'm Lucy Richards, Senior Editor at DK Eyewitness.
And welcome to Where to Go, where every fortnight we find out more about the world's favourite travel destinations with the people who know those places best. And today, Lucy, we're covering some of the best destinations to visit this winter with some DK Eyewitness experts.
Yes, which is wonderful because obviously, James, you and I won't be going anywhere this winter.
Absolutely nowhere. Yeah, you may have heard, if you've listened to your previous episodes, that both me and Lucy will be pretty indisposed of this winter with
little ones.
The sound of tiny little feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that the phrase? I don't know. But there we go. So I think we're just going to live vicariously through some of the amazing destinations that our guests are going to talk about. So there's going to be a few familiar faces, podcast listeners will be pleased to know, and one new face as well. So first up, we've got the recommendations of friend of the pod, Dan Stables. He'll be taking us through some winter recommendations for Europe. So welcome, Dan.
Welcome.
Thanks very much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So listeners, you'll remember Dan from the Manchester episode from a few seasons back. And since then, he's been very, very busy with the Hungry Ghost podcast, which is fantastic. Highly recommend you all go and check it out. But Dan is back for our very special episode today to take us through three very special winter locations, which we will be going through right now. Right, so do you want to introduce us to your first destination?
Sure, yeah. So the first place I've chosen is Andalusia in southern Spain.
Mm. What sets Andalusia apart then from the rest of Spain, Dan?
I guess the kind of the biggest thing, culturally speaking, is the sort of Moorish influence. So for something like 700 years, I think the 8th to the 15th centuries, it was Al-Andalus, it was under Moorish control. And so it has a very strong sort of Islamic influence and North African influence. And so the architecture there is like this amazing fusion between Christian and Islamic style. The food as well has that influence. Lots of desserts with like honey and almonds and stuff like that in. And so it's kind of got a very distinctive, culturally very distinctive feel. But then it's, I mean, weather-wise, it's kind of different from the rest of Spain. You know, they call Seville the frying pan of Europe because it's so hot in the summer.
Yep.
So it's kind of, I mean, in my opinion, it's nicer weather in the winter than it is in the summer. You're talking about 17 degrees Celsius in December in Seville. So nice bit of winter sun if you're going from the UK.
Because I know it does get up to about 43 or so in the summer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It can go really, really high.
That's too hot in my opinion.
Far too hot, absolutely.
Yeah. It's also kind of quieter as well because the high season over there is sort of March to June and then September to October or November. So Where might be kind of shoulder seasons in other parts of the world is their sort of high season. So wintertime is a bit quieter, so a bit smaller crowds.
Mm.
And there's loads of like famous sites in Andalusia. I mean, one that comes to everyone's mind is the Alhambra.
Mm-hmm.
But tell us some things that listeners really shouldn't miss when they're visiting.
Well, I'll say, I mean, yeah, you said it and it is a bit obvious, but the Alhambra is like an absolute must. It's like, I'd say it's probably the most amazing building that I've ever seen, which obviously it's subjective, but even pushes out the Taj Mahal for that title, in my opinion.
Wow.
Yeah, and again, it's just this kind of amazing blend of architectural styles. I call it Nasrid architecture, but it's like mixture of sort of Gothic influence and then Islamic influence, this amazing geometrical carvings and stuff like that. And the scale of it is amazing. It's on the top of this hill overlooking Granada, and you've got like these really dark sort of, I think it's cypress trees, like framing it. It's just, you go to these viewpoints where you can, which are really busy, even in December, people taking pictures of it. And it is just an amazing thing to look at from a distance, and then when you go there up close, it's even more amazing. And again, it's busy year round, but December is probably one of the quietest times of year, I would say, probably, to go. So yeah, it's worth doing. You've got to book it in advance to make sure that you can get in, but got to be done.
Yeah, because it is kind of like a sort of city inside a building, isn't it?
Yeah,
the vast scale of it is huge. It's always been on my list, and I don't know why I've never been. Listeners will hear that so many times. But yeah, I've always wanted to go, and actually really helpful to know that December is a little bit quieter as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you can spend all day in there. It's like you say, it's a massive complex of gardens and buildings and stuff, but they give you a timed slot for the Nasrid palaces, which is like the most famous part. And then you have to stick to your slot for that, but then the rest of the time you can just wander around. You can go to the Henarelife, which is like this, was the sort of pleasure gardens for the kings that lived there. Just an amazing, amazing place. Somewhere else, I mean, on a kind of similar note, again, it's really, really famous, but it's got to be done, is the Mezquita in Cordoba, which is, they also call it the Mosque Cathedral because it was a mosque and then it was a cathedral, and then it was like, it's kind of encapsulates the kind of influence that the Moorish rule had, and then the Reconquista, as they called it, when Christians took control again of that part of Spain. So now it's a cathedral, but it's like got these amazing sort of Moorish arches, and very distinctive, like red and white sort of candy cane striped arches. And it's, yeah, again, it's just probably one of the most amazing buildings that I've ever seen. The Alcázar in Seville is another one, which was a royal palace.
Yeah.
Again, just stunning. It's kind of less like, I don't know, it feels a bit less old somehow than the Alhambra. I don't know if it is less old, but it's like, you know, the gardens are still very well tended and all that. It sort of feels like you step into it and you're like, well, you could be, you know, back in its heyday sort of thing. And yeah, again, just absolutely amazing architecture. There, some of that isn't a building so much is, again, in Granada, if you're into sort of writing poetry in any way, then there's a couple of things that you can do to do with Federico García Lorca, who was like probably Spain's most famous poet. And he was very much associated with Granada. Mm. And you can go to his house. So there's a museum there as well. And yeah, various places you can sort of walk in his footsteps in Granada as well.
It's a good spread.
Brilliant cultural tour.
Yeah. So moving away from buildings and culture and talking about something that I'm not very au fait with, but outdoor activities, Dan, what can you get up to in winter there?
Well, again, I mean, if you're just sort of trying to get away from the heat, which a lot of people, even Andalusians, do, you know, if you go in August, it's the cities are pretty much deserted because they all go to the mountains. So the Sierra Nevada mountains are obviously cooler because you're on a higher elevation and you can go hiking there. You can also, I mean, away, not quite so much in the mountains, but there's an amazing hiking trail. It's near Malaga, actually, called the Caminito del Rey, the King's Path, which is like this walkway. It's like literally affixed onto the walls, on the side of the walls, of a really steep gorge. It's one of the most famous walking trails in Spain. And I'd recommend doing that in the cooler months, certainly rather than the height of summer.
Mm.
But also in winter, you can, believe it or not, go skiing in Andalusia.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw this in your notes. I want to know more.
Yeah. Europe's southernmost ski resort is a place called Pradoiano, and it's in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And I mean, I don't think it's quite up there with, you know, the Verbiers of this world in terms of development and stuff like that. But it's a place that you can go skiing in southern Spain, which is not something you'd necessarily associate with that part of the world.
Amazing.
Absolutely not. And finally on Andalusia, I mean, you said about December being a good point to visit. Tell us about some of the Christmas celebrations and what makes them particularly special.
as you can probably imagine, they go pretty mad for Christmas in Spain in general, including in Andalusia. So, I mean, there are nativity scenes absolutely everywhere you look. Literally every...
Of course.
Maybe not every, but loads of shop windows. I'm reliably informed that pretty much every office will have a nativity scene, schools and stuff, obviously. Whereas over here, you know, nativity performances and plays and stuff might be limited to maybe primary school kids. Certainly in my experience.
I was always one of the wise men.
Yeah, me too. Me too, actually. Or a shepherd, maybe, occasionally.
I'd never made it up to the ranks of shepherd. So.
Yeah, but they, so they'll, over there, quite a lot of towns will actually have, you know, like live action nativity performances where the townsfolk will dress up and do it in the squares and stuff, play out the nativity. What else? Desserts, in particular. I mean, various sort of Christmas foods, but in particular, sweet foods. So they've got almond teron, which is like an almond sort of nougat thing, which you get everywhere. And wine donuts, believe it or not, as well. So it's like kind of more like a cookie than a donut, but it's like shaped like a ring donut. And it's got sweet wine, like sort of sherry, I think like fino type wine in the mixture.
Lovely.
Of the sort of cookie dough. And it makes like a nice sweet sort of slightly winey donut cookie type thing.
Great.
And then also actually not Christmas, but if you stay there for New Year, famously in that part of Spain, they do the old, on the strike of midnight, you've got to try and eat 12 grapes.
yeah.
With every strike.
With every strike, yeah. And if you manage to do it, I think you get good luck for the rest of the year. I don't know what happens to you if you don't.
Have you given it a go?
Yeah, we did it. We were there in for New Year just gone, actually. I was in, I think it was Granada. We did a tour of Seville, Granada, Cordoba, and got the grapes in.
You got the grapes in. Success.
Yeah, so, and it's been a pretty good year so far,
good.
So
okay.
Maybe there's some truth in it.
Ah, very nice. And you've chosen a very different destination for your second choice, Dan. Do you want to tell us a bit about Iceland?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Iceland, you know, probably one of those places, if you think of like a wintry landscape covered in ice, snow, you might think of Iceland. But yeah, I was lucky enough to go to Iceland a couple of winters ago in November and December. I was there, and like a lot of places, it's amazing year round. I think it's great for hiking and stuff in the summer as well. But you know, if you go there in the winter, you really get the proper spectacular sort of land of ice and fire experience. So you can see, like, you know, the ice fields and stuff. I was lucky enough to go hiking, well, I don't know if you call it a hike, but like exploring in ice caves, which are inside a glacier, which was pretty amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's in a place called, this is where I try and pronounce Icelandic words. It's called Vatnajökull National Park.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, famous for its sort of glacier fields. And then, I mean, part of the beauty of Iceland is nowhere's that far away from anywhere. So I think at that point, I was still staying in Reykjavik, and we just drove out into the countryside to this place, got out of the van, and then walked for a bit. 20 minutes later, suddenly we were walking on top of a glacier, and then there was like a hole inside of it, a cave, and went in it. And then, yeah, I mean, it's kind of impossible to explain other than you're literally in like an amazing cave of ice, which looks as if it's been sort of chipped away because of all the like the angles and the patterns, but it, you know, it hasn't. It's just formed that way, and it's
completely natural.
Yeah, and they form differently every single year, obviously, because it's ice, so it melts and then freezes again. So it's quite an amazing experience, actually, to be able to explore a landscape like that, which is only going to be there like that when you're there in that moment. So yeah, that's a must-do if you're in Iceland, I would say, over the winter.
You say about kind of like winter being the chance to see the kind of complete Iceland. I know people have started going like all year round and in summer and spring, but is that because all the ice and snow is actually there? And I'm guessing you've got the full wrap-up experience as well in terms of getting the layers on.
Yeah, you do. It's actually kind of less cold than I was expecting it to be. I mean, it was pretty cold, but it wasn't that cold. But also that time of year is the only time really that you can see the Northern Lights, if you're lucky.
That's what I was going to ask, Dan. So I think you have seen the Northern Lights.
Yeah, I have. I was very lucky. So I think, like a lot of people, I was chatting to my tour guide. I did a tour with a really good company called Hidden Iceland. And we did a tour that was like a few days long. And we went out to various of the national parks and stuff. And I was chatting to him, and he said sometimes he does the Northern Lights tours, which is just specific. You go out from Reykjavik at night and you drive around on a bus for 4 hours and, you know, you hope to see the Northern Lights. But he said people are so often disappointed because they're so unpredictable, the Northern Lights. It has to be the perfect combination of, you know, atmospheric conditions, no cloud, And he said pretty much every time he's seen them has been kind of by accident. And sure enough, my girlfriend came to Reykjavik just for the weekend. I was in Iceland for a couple of weeks. And we did that tour and didn't get to see anything. But then when I was out on this multi-day tour, and we were just in the middle of the countryside somewhere and near some kind of like hot springs place, because there's like apps on people's phones that you can kind of track whether it's likely you might see them where you are that night. And a guide had said to us, look, you know, don't get your hopes up, but there's a possibility they might show themselves tonight. And then I was asleep. It was at like 1-2 in the morning, and I sort of heard down the corridor of the hotel, like, you know, shuffling of feet and murmuring. And I literally thought, I cannot be bothered to get out of bed. I was like half awake. But then I was thinking, I better had, because it might be the Northern Lights. So managed to get myself out of bed, and sure enough, it was the Northern Lights outside. And just this, I mean, I think what I saw was not by any means the most spectacular showing of the Northern Lights, but it was still pretty spectacular. You know, the classic sort of green and bit of red and just this band of light sort of across the sky, and went on for maybe half an hour, and then it stopped. And yeah, amazing thing to see, but completely by accident.
Was your girlfriend there at that point, Dan, or had she gone?
No, she'd gone home.
Oh no. So,
oh no, what
she
a
was
shame.
Not best pleased about
no,
that.
No, I'm sure.
But, you know, sadly it's just the way it is over there. You can't really predict it.
I guess that's part of what makes it so special as well, is the fact that it can't be planned.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What I will say about the Northern Lights is they're worth getting out of bed for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I can totally imagine that. And you mentioned a bit about staying in Reykjavik and spending a few weeks there and stuff. I remember we touched on Reykjavik a little bit in a previous episode of the podcast, but I think it's kind of like becoming one of Europe's kind of coolest new cities in a way, isn't it? Any kind of recommendations for that?
I mean, it is a really cool city, and it's very, I mean, it's so, even calling it a city seems kind of like, of course it is a city, it's a capital city, but it's so small that it's very accessible. You know, you can get pretty much everywhere on foot. And yeah, there's some really cool things to see there. There's the Hallgrímskirkja. I think that I'm pronouncing that right. Probably not. But that's like an amazing sort of really like modern sort of space age like church building. I think it was quite controversial when it was built because it's so unusual looking. But that's quite a cool thing to see. There's some great food. There's some not so great food as well. You might have heard of the fermented shark dish that they have over there.
Yeah, I have. Was it good? We're getting into Hungry Ghost territory here, aren't we?
We are a bit, yeah, but I'm not sure I'd say it was good. I mean, they bring it in a little sort of sealed, hermetically sealed jar thing, and which kind of says it already, because they don't want like other diners to be able to smell it. So you're meant to just open it, seal it again, and then have a little cube of shark meat. It's like fermented Greenland shark on a cocktail stick, and then you eat it, and it's kind of tastes like hair dye is how I would describe it. Like the smell of hair dye. You know, it's an experience.
It's an experience.
Yeah.
Maybe not as important as seeing as the Northern Lights.
Yeah, maybe not.
Excellent. All right. So should we move on to your third and final destination? And we are going back into South Europe here. So you've selected Malta.
I have. Yeah.
Which is very much a traditional summer destination in my view. So I'm quite interested to hear about it in winter.
Well, I think it's kind of slightly less extreme than, for example, Seville, places like that. It's quite nice still, temperatures in the summer, but quite similar in the winter. So I think probably something like 17, 18 degrees Celsius in December. So it's good for a winter sun destination if that's what you're looking for. It's also, I would say, I mean, Malta's got these amazing, really, really ancient historic sites that you can go and see. There are temples there, which are some of the oldest buildings in the world, in fact, which I'm not even going to try and pronounce because I think Icelandic was beyond me and Maltese even more so. But yeah, the megalithic temples, they're known as a whole of Malta. And I think if you want to go and explore stuff like that, which I would completely recommend doing, you know, doing it in the heat of summer, it's probably not the best sort of time. Winter temperatures are probably a bit better for that, I would say. And again, it's just quieter than, because like you said, it's famous as a summer destination. And it's great to go in the summer, but I think it's probably significantly quieter actually in December, January sort of time.
And away from, because obviously Malta is thousands and thousands of years old, away from that sort of history and culture, I think the coastline's meant to be pretty amazing.
It's stunning. I mean, sadly, there was the famous sort of rock arch off, I think it was off Gozo, which is no longer there, just collapsed for, you know, from natural causes, which I never got to see, but that would have been an amazing thing to see. But yeah, there's all sorts of amazing cliffs, coves, lagoons and stuff. There's the Blue Lagoon, which I did a boat trip to the Blue Lagoon where, kind of is what it says in the tin. It's a very blue lagoon, amazing water.
I can attest to that. It's very blue. I've seen it.
And I think nearby there's, is it the Crystal Lagoons, which are, again, very crystal clear water, and you can go snorkeling and stuff and swimming. And yeah, so it's definitely a boat trip would be high on the list of things to do there, I would say.
Mm. What did you think of the cuisine over there? Because I know it's like quite a bit of a, it's a kind of meeting place of loads of different cultures, Malta. Mm. You kind of got an Italian influence, you've got an English influence, strangely, and then you've also got kind of almost an Arabic African influence as well, slightly.
Yeah.
But yeah, does it, I'm guessing lots of delicious seafood.
Yeah, a lot of delicious seafood, a lot of sort of salted fish, which I think is possibly like, you know, from maybe a Portuguese influence or something like that. But there is the very, as you touched on, a very noticeable British influence on various elements of the culture, but including the cuisine. Bovril is very popular in Malta, bizarrely.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Huh.
I don't know where they got this idea from, but they eat it mixed with pastina and laughing cow cheese.
Oh.
Which is like a popular childhood dish, apparently, which sounds pretty awful to me, but...
Sounds kind of wintery, though. It sounds like a British wintery dish, never mind a Maltese one.
Well, interestingly, a lot of the food is very sort of hearty, like more than you might expect. Mm. I'd recommend very much going to... there's a restaurant in the Malta Maritime Museum, which is in Valletta, and they do a tasting menu from, or at least when I was there, they did a tasting menu from 1757. So it was meant to be like a snapshot of, you know, the various influences at that time on Maltese cuisine. So they had things like rabbit stew, but they also had like maghrebi lentil soup, and they had a pasta, like a baked pasta sort of thing, these sort of Italian influence. So yeah, the food's really interesting.
So you can go enjoy all of that and then have some Bovril afterwards.
Exactly, a nice dessert of Bovril and laughing cow cheese. Why not?
And finally on Malta, just to touch on it, did you have much of a chance to explore the smaller islands as well, like Gozo and Camino? I remember Gozo being pretty sort of almost wild, kind of like quite rural.
So like I said, I did a boat trip to the Blue Lagoon, which is off Camino, but didn't get to explore Camino on land. Gozo went to very briefly, and yeah, it's just very, very sort of rural and quiet and yeah, sort of land that time forgot, sort of in the nicest possible way. So yeah, it's very, very chilled. I think quite a lot of operators do like a tour to Gozo, and then you go out into the countryside and you have a picnic, and then you get back on the boat and then you go back, and it's just very nice, like chilled way to spend a day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very nice. Well, I think those are three brilliant ways of spending your winter. So thanks very much, Dan. Very, very different as well, all three of them.
Yeah.
It's always good, and always good to talk food as well with you, Dan. I knew a few disgusting things would turn up.
Glad to be of service.
Next up, new to the podcast, we have DK's Senior Manager for Digital Strategy, Leela Siddiqui, joining us from New York City to talk about her US winter recommendations. So welcome, Leela.
Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
We are chuffed to have you, Leela. It's so nice to be speaking to you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us then about your first recommendation and what makes it special in winter.
So definitely the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania in the winter. There's tons of activities to do. I usually go there and visit with my friends or my family. We'll go skiing, snowboarding. I actually can't do either of those things, so I go snow tubing, which is basically going down a giant slope in a giant tire. And it's super fun. And yeah, it's just a great cozy time.
Lovely. And the Poconos seem pretty accessible as well, right? They're not too far from like New York or Philadelphia. Are they kind of easy to get to from those cities?
Yeah, definitely. From New York, it's about 2 to 3 hours. And from Philly, I believe it's a bit shorter. I actually have friends in Philly and we've met in the middle.
Nice.
And it's been pretty easy to get to for all of us.
Cool. I have to say the tubing sounds absolutely amazing. I cannot ski or snowboard, so Leela, I'd be joining you on
Great.
That. But what other kinds of things can visitors do in the Poconos?
So I feel like the Poconos are just a great year-round destination. Obviously, in the winter, you have the winter activities. And if those don't suit, you can also go snowshoeing, which is basically a winter hike with snowshoes. A little wonky to get around or get used to, but, you know, it's just very, very spectacular. I mean, the Poconos are beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's just this region with forest, lakes, and valleys. So there's so much to do year-round. In the spring and summer, we usually go up for hiking. The Delaware Water Gap region hosts river tubing. So you just get a cooler with drinks, get on a raft, and just let the river take you anywhere. And same with the fall, except with that, you have the fall foliage. So yeah, it's just a great year-round destination.
Awesome. And are there any particular sort of resorts or towns that you would recommend staying in the Poconos?
Yeah, so the highest point of the region is Camelback Mountain, and there's a major resort there. So you can go there for skiing, snowboarding, things like that. And they have, you know, the cozy chalets nearby you can rent. And the main resort has great food, great drinks. So it's a really nice place to visit. The second would be the Delaware Water Gap region, because that has the sort of river hiking, things like that, that you can do.
Nice.
Cool.
So Lila, does it feel Christmassy when you go in winter?
Oh, definitely. It's like, you know, when you're in New York, you don't get as much snow and there's buildings everywhere. So it's like you're in a winter wonderland when you're there, just rolling hills of snow, and, you know, you can get cozy with hot chocolate. It really feels like you're in North Pole in a good way.
Wonderful.
Well, if we're going from sort of like a cozy destination in the north of America, let's go quite far south. Tell us a little bit about where you've chosen for your second destination, Lila.
So I'm from Texas, so I chose San Antonio, which is not a far drive from Dallas, about 2 to 3 hours as well.
And what makes San Antonio such a great city to visit?
So San Antonio has just a very rich cultural history. There's the Alamo, which is sort of the main attraction there. It was a church that was integral in the battle for independence between Texas and Mexico. So there's a museum there. But in general, there's some really nice sites like the Riverwalk. There's art galleries, and there's other museums as well. And the food is incredible.
And are there any kind of special events that sort of bring the city to life over winter?
Yeah, so the Riverwalk is usually transformed with lights, and nearby churches are decorated with candles. It's just such a sight.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. Can we just circle back, though, to the food? Because Texas
has... It's a theme
has...
this episode,
Lucy. Yeah, the food. Texas obviously has such a unique cuisine. What are some of the things that you would recommend visitors must try when they visit?
So, you know, I think people often think of Mexican food as burritos and quesadillas, and that would be more of a Tex-Mex thing. In San Antonio, during the winter especially, you can get some really great comfort food that is, you know, traditional Mexican cuisine. So you can get pozole, which is like this really aromatic, delicious stew. You can also have tamales. And of course, mole, which is this savory chocolate sauce that you can have with chicken and rice. Mexican food is just very much comfort food. So in the winter, when you're in San Antonio, you will have your fill.
Excellent. Sign me up. I'm kind of there. I lost you at mole. It was that's excellent. Obviously, you're quite far away from the Poconos in San Antonio. What kind of temperatures can you expect during winter?
It's actually very mild. It doesn't get too cold. I can only speak in Fahrenheit. It could probably go down to the 30s at night. But usually, it's very mild, kind of like LA would be in the winter. You know, light jacket weather, maybe throw on a coat at night, but it's usually pretty mild.
Sounds lovely. Well, thank you very much, Lila. Great podcast debut, and hopefully we'll have you back on again soon.
Thank you so much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So next up, we have returning guest, senior editor Zoe Rutland. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you.
Welcome, Zoe.
So nice to have you back.
Great to be here.
And so you're going to be talking to us about where to go in Asia this winter.
Yes, I am.
So where are we kicking off with?
So we're kicking off with Seoul.
Cool.
And I'm just going to start by taking us through what makes Seoul a great place to go in winter. And I'm going to start with a cliche. But that is that Seoul has Seoul in the winter. It's just, there's generally just quite a magical air about the city in the winter. Temples and palaces get blanketed in snow, people cozy up in tea houses and saunas. But on a practical level, crowds are at an all-time low because summers are really humid and prices are much more expensive in the summer and it's full of visitors. So winter's just a great time to go. To keep prices low, you have more of the city to yourself. And yeah, winter just has its charms for many reasons.
And can you tell us a sort of a couple of the best things to do in Seoul during winter?
Yeah, so super heavy snowfall is rare in Seoul, but it can still be really brutally cold there. So it's a perfect time to go to a Jimjilbang. And this literally means heated room. And it's basically a bathhouse that locals visit to hang out in and unwind in year round. But they obviously provide an entirely different sense of comfort in the winter. So, I mean, personally, what better way is there to warm up than soaking in a hot bath and sweating out in a sauna? And then you go and unwind in a communal sleeping room. It just sounds lush. Cool. So there's that. And there's, if you'd rather stay dry and not sweat it out, but you want to still be cozy and warm, you can go to a traditional tea house. There are so many across Seoul, and many of them are located in traditional Korean buildings, which are called hanok. And these buildings, they traditionally have an underfloor heating system. So you'll have coziness emanating from below you, as well as that steaming cup of tea in your hand. So that's another lovely activity to do in the winter.
Amazing.
And the last thing I'm going to mention is that for people who are fans of the bracing cold, which I'm not a fan of going out in the cold, but there is reason to stay outdoors in Seoul. Obviously, I've already mentioned that temples get snow-capped and it's just generally very beautiful in the winter. But one of the main ways to get into the winter spirit in Seoul is by visiting an ice skating rink. So many pop up around the city and the locals love them. And the most popular tends to be the Seoul City Hall ice rink, and that's in the middle of Seoul Plaza. And it's quite good because there's one rink for new skaters and one for the more experienced, so you can choose between them. But they both have a view of a really huge, lovely Christmas tree that sits up. And there is also the Olympic Park ice skating rink, which is a pretty cool place to skate. It's where the 1988 Seoul Olympics were held, so it has incredible views of the Olympic Park arches and the famous Lotte Tower. So yeah, those are some of the best things to do across winter.
That sounds a lot sort of more cozy than what I'd associate Seoul as being.
Yes, that's the word I was going to use. So cozy.
Yeah, I often think of like Seoul as being like kind of very technological, very, I don't know, like thinking of K-pop, K-drama, etc. That sounds like much more homely almost.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why it's such a great place to go in the winter, because it's not as crowded and you can just kind of cozy up and do all of those lovely things.
I think you mentioned Christmas trees, but are there any other sort of particular events or festivals happening in Seoul in winter?
Yeah, so I can quickly touch on Christmas because it is celebrated as a national holiday and people do tend to spend the day with friends and families. Christmas, you know, like most cities around the world, it takes over the city. There are Christmas lights strung in shopping malls and skating rinks, decked out in Christmas trees. But something that would be great to touch on is Solal, which is Lunar New Year. And that happens at the tail end of winter in January or February. And it's all about ringing in the new year according to the lunar calendar. Happens across Korea, but in Seoul in particular, many museums, those that aren't closed for the holiday, they host special events, so traditional performances and games. And yeah, it's just a great time to gather and eat delicious food, share words of wisdom for the new year. So yeah, that's probably one of the best events over the winter in Seoul.
You mentioned a bit of food there, and we can't touch on Korea or Seoul without talking a little bit about food. Are there any kind of like dishes that are popular in winter?
Yeah, so you've got the kind of dishes that stave off the winter chills. So you've got comforting bowls of gomtang, which is a soup of beef and rice, and that's seasoned to taste. Obviously, you can't go to Korea and not have some kimchi. You've got kimchi jjigae, which is a hearty bowl of hot kimchi stew. But also, if you're wandering around street food markets, which you should be doing in Seoul because it's a highlight of the food scene, you've got tteokbokki, which is a classic, and it's a classic street food dish, and it lends itself really well to the winter because it's tends to be very hot and spicy. It's soft, chewy rice cakes simmered in a sweet and spicy sauce, so it will heat you up from the inside out. And then the last thing I'll mention in terms of Seoul and food is Korean barbecue. So going to a barbecue joint is an everyday pastime in Seoul, but I would argue that it's probably better in winter because you're grilling meat on hot coals and you're warming up with shots of soju. So yeah, you want to do that in the winter. You don't want to be sweating out in the summer doing that.
Totally. Yeah, you're spot on.
Yes, absolutely. That sounds very lovely. I mean, we keep saying cozy, but yeah, it's a totally different side to Seoul than I've ever sort of seen before. So you've got a second destination, Zoe. I know you've been working on Hello South Korea, our book, for a book about sort of Korea and Korean culture.
And Seoul Like a Local as well.
And Seoul Like a Local.
Yep.
But I know your next project is Be More Japan, the next edition of that. And that takes us to Japan. So whereabouts in Japan are we specifically going to?
Yes, so we're going to one of the northernmost of the main islands in Japan. So it's Hokkaido, and it's one of the five largest islands. And it's actually known as a region of fire and ice. So it's great for the winter. And it's characterized by its looming volcanoes, its fertile plains, and the perfect skiing conditions. So for many of these reasons, people attest that it feels like a different world to the rest of Japan.
And see, you mentioned about the skiing. Why is it such a great place specifically for visitors to go in winter?
So Hokkaido stands out for its heavy snows. So its capital is Sapporo, and that gets a whopping 6 meters or 20 feet of snow annually. And temperatures in the winter can dip as low as minus 15 degrees or 5 Fahrenheit. So it gets pretty cold and pretty snowy, but that makes it a haven for winter sports. And it's also got the most reliable ski season in the world. So it's got great quality powder, and that's arguably found in Niseko.
Okay.
Which also has great après ski and excellent conditions for snowboarding if you're not into skiing and you want to do something a bit different. But then for those people that don't like winter sports, there are also outdoor onsen or hot springs, which are known here as Rotenburo. And Hokkaido has, as I've mentioned, it has smouldering volcanoes. Hokkaido has more Rotenburo than any other prefecture in Japan. So you can give the skiing a miss and you can simply relax in steaming waters and just overlook wintry surrounds. So you still get those great views, but you're not doing as much of the work.
I'll be doing that one.
A bit of both. Something for everyone. Fantastic. And yeah, I mean, I know Hokkaido is kind of being like, in terms of the Japanese islands, it's probably the one that I kind of know the least about, or the area that I know the least about. Are there any kind of like particular events or festivals kind of going on during winter?
Yeah, so many events see people through the cold months, but I would say the most famous is the annual Sapporo Snow Festival. And that is hundreds of giant, intricate sculptures that have been crafted from ice and snow, and they take over the central parts of the city. And it basically becomes a fairy tale land of ice. And that happens in early February. Yeah. And I would say it's even more epic to witness it at night because the sculptures, which often are of global landmarks or even sci-fi characters, they're illuminated with neon lights. So it's very cool. And so, like I said, it happens in early Feb, but it overlaps with the Sapporo White Illumination Festival. And that takes place for a longer period of time. So if you're visiting from mid-November to mid-Feb, you'll see strings of white lights adorning the same areas that these ice sculptures take over.
Very pretty.
Anyone who listens to the podcast knows that James and I are obsessed with anything food related. So tell us then, any recommendations on dishes for winter?
Yep. So much like Seoul, I would say that it's staving off the winter chills with hearty comfort food. And you've got some really great regional dishes in this area. So these include things like springy noodles and miso heavy soup. So Sapporo ramen is really great. And warming soup curries. The last thing that I'll end with is a hot pot dish, which is nabemono. And that will really keep you warm, especially if you have that with some hot sake.
Excellent. Yeah, eating and drinking all the way. Some fantastic Asian winter destinations, Zoe. Thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks, Zoe.
Oh, wow. So huge thank you to all of our guests. I think we've gone around the world.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking back to some of Dan's foodie recommendations.
I was going to say all of the food, to be honest.
It's not a Where to Go podcast without a lot of chat about food. And I'm really, really hungry now. But yeah, thanks so much to Dan, to Leela and to Zoe as well. We hope you've enjoyed this, listener, and have got a few bits of inspiration for your own winter getaways. I'll be planning it for next winter, unfortunately.
Yes, indeed. 2024.
2024 is our year for sure. And so we don't know necessarily where we're going next time. It'll be a total surprise, but we shall see you in a fortnight. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And we shall see you very soon. Where to Go is a podcast from DK Eyewitness. It was produced by Julia Baker, presented by Lucy Richards and James Atkinson with the help of Bella Talbot. For more information about DK Eyewitness, follow us on social media at DK Eyewitness or visit dk.com/eyewitness. And please like and follow the show. And if you have time, leave a review. Your support means so much to us.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.